two films, one theme. This is Words and Movies.
All right. Thank you once again, Rebecca, and welcome to yet another episode of Words and Movies. I am your co-host, Claude Call.
And I'm your other co-host, Sean Gallagher. And today is our 50th episode, not counting our introductory episode. And so we're going to talk about TV or
not TV.
The way that movies and TV have interacted with each other. Specifically, there have been a number of movies that were spin-offs of TV shows. Arguably, the best one of those was the movie of The Fugitive, made almost 30 years ago. And then there have also been a number of TV shows that were explicitly based on movies. Arguably the most famous, certainly the longest running, was MASH, which ran for 11 seasons, nearly three times as long as the Korean War, which it was set against. And then there have also been movies that quote-unquote inspired TV shows. They were not The TV shows were not specifically based on them, but there was enough of each movie and each TV show that certain people became suspicious, let's just say. And the movies we're going to be talking about that fit that category are, from 1953, Stalag 17, directed and co-written by Billy Wilder, and from 1992, Singles, written and directed by Cameron Crowe. In addition to the fact that both of these movies inspired TV shows, both of those TV shows were sitcoms, so both movies are comedies, although there's quite a bit of dramatic elements included in both of them, specifically Stalag 17. Also, Cameron Crowe was and is a huge fan of Billy Wilder, and Wilder, once he got to see them, liked most, if not all, of the movies Crowe had directed while Wilder was still alive. And finally, if you talk to fans of both Wilder and Crowe and ask them what their favorite movies by each actor, each director is, these movies would probably not rank too high on the list, but I happen to love both of these movies, and I hope to convince you of their merits throughout this episode. So right now, Claude, without further ado, is going to give us the plot description for Stalag 17.
Yes, indeed. It is a few days before Christmas, 1944, and we are at the German prisoner of war camp called Stalag 17, where two American POWs named Manfredi and Johnson, they're inmates of Barracks 4, are preparing their escape. The story's narrator, Cookie, who is one of the prisoners, played by Gil Stratton, he suggests that there might be a traitor among the men of Barracks 4. The men have secretly been digging a tunnel from their latrine to a post just past the barbed wire fence that marks out the edge of the camp. And after going over their plan to sneak into Switzerland, Manfredi and Johnson get out of the barracks through a trapdoor that's hidden under their wood stove, and they sneak into the latrine. They crawl through the tunnel and they start digging to the surface past the barbed wire fence. Inside the barracks, the men are speculating how long it's going to take for their comrades to come up beyond the fence. They start to predict that their escapees will make it all the way, when one of them, a man played by William Holden, and his name is Sefton, he bets out two packs of cigarettes that the men won't even make it out of the forest nearby. The other men, most of whom don't like Sefton, bet against him. Outside, Manfredi and Johnson dig to the surface, and they're about to leave when they discover several German soldiers pretty much waiting for them. They open fire, and they kill both men. Inside the barracks, the remaining prisoners, including Sefton, hear the gunfire and realize their friends could not have possibly escaped. The hot-headed Duke, played by Neville Brand, demands an explanation from the barracks security officer, Price. Price, who is played by Peter Graves, says he doesn't have an answer. Meanwhile, Sefton and Cookie gather up the cigarettes that Sefton has won in the bet, and they store them in a footlocker that he is keeping under his bed. The next morning, the entire camp is turned out for roll call. Barracks 4 is overseen by Sergeant Schultz, who is a jolly fellow who the men have absolutely no trust or respect for, and who's played by Sig Ron. Out in the yard, the men are addressed by the camp commandant, Oberst von Scherbach, who is played by Otto Preminger. Von Scherbach tells the men that his guards successfully prevented the escape from the night before, and that no man has ever escaped from his camp alive. He also has the corpses of Manfredi and Johnson just lying there in the mud and uncovered for all the men to see. The barracks fort chief, Hoffman, played by Richard Erdman, protests the treatment of the bodies and demands that they have a proper burial. Von Scherbach agrees to do so, but he also notes that being caught outside the barracks after lights out means being shot on sight. Also, the stove in Barracks 4 will be removed, so it can't be used to camouflage the trapdoor that the men cut in the floor, and the men will also have to fill in the tunnel that they dug. Von Scherbach also announces that each barracks will be given a small Christmas tree and that all the prisoners will go through delousing. One of the prisoners, a shell-shocked soldier played by Robinson Stone by the name of Joey, he begins to play his ocarina, which is taken away by another prisoner who is commonly called Animal. Animal is played by Robert Strauss. While the commandant talks and uses this mocking tone, Animal throws the ocarina at the water in front of the commandant, splashing his boots with mud. The commandant demands the guilty man step forward. Animal does, but he's followed moments later by several other men. Eventually, the entire prisoner population admits to being Spartacus, covering for Animal. The commandant cancels the Christmas trees and tells the men they'll be deloused with cold water from the camp's fire hoses instead. After the men clean up in their latrines and following an incident where Animal is nearly shot for crossing the barbed wire of the camp because he is lusting after Russian female prisoners, the men go back to their barracks for breakfast. Sefton fries himself an egg in front of the other prisoners, and when they ask him how he paid for it, he says he bartered it using the cigarettes that he'd won the night before. The other men are very angry that Sefton would use cigarettes that he'd gotten as a result of the deaths of their comrades, but Sefton says, hey, many other prisoners trade with the Germans, and life in the camp is such that thievery is common. Duke tells Sefton that collusion with the Germans could get him hurt or killed, and a fight breaks out. Hoffman immediately breaks it up, and Sefton claims he has indigestion, and he gives the egg to Joey. Price asks Sefton how he could be so sure that Manfredi and Johnson wouldn't make it to freedom. Sefton says he doesn't know for sure, but he just liked the odds of the situation. Sefton also tells his comrades that they're wasting their time and risking their lives unnecessarily by trying to escape. His plan is to just ride out the war as a prisoner and keep himself alive. The barracks of the camp, all of them, share a ham radio that they keep hidden and they use to listen to the BBC and other communications about the war. The radio is smuggled throughout the compound by Marco, who is played by William Pearson, and his partner Steve, who is on crutches because he lost a leg in combat. They use his empty pant leg to hide various items, including the radio. Steve, by the way, is played by an uncredited A. Gerald Singer. When the radio is brought to Barracks 4, Marco tells them that they can have it only for 2 days instead of a week, because the traitor in their barracks is known to the rest of the camp, and the other barracks chiefs are afraid that the radio will be discovered. The men set up the radio immediately, using some chicken wire as the antenna, which doubles as their volleyball net. One of the prisoners, Blondie, is a radio expert and begins to report about military actions in Europe. The news he picks up is about the Battle of the Bulge. Just then, Schultz arrives to seize the barrack stove, and the radio is hidden in a false bottom of a pail of water. Hoffman and Duke try to grill Schultz about the barrack spy, but Schultz tells them nothing. Schultz also notices that a signal from the spy has been left for him. It's a loop that was tied in the cord for one of the light bulbs hanging from the rafters. After he tells the men to report outside to fill in the tunnel, he goes to the chessboard and picks up the Black Queen. Inside the piece is a rolled-up note. He switches the queen for an identical piece, pulls the loop out of the cord, and walks out. While the men uncover the escape tunnel that they dug, they notice a horse-drawn cart going by with the coffins of Manfredi and Johnson. The men all remove their hats in respect. Cookie narrates for a while about Sefton himself, who has built a substantial business for himself, based mostly on the trading of cigarettes. Sefton has several successful businesses going on, including distilling schnapps from potato peels, horse races that involve mice and a homemade track, and a telescope that the men use to peek into the delousing shack in the Russian compound where the female prisoners are being disinfected. Hoffman, Price, and Duke are not pleased with Sefton, thinking that the Germans will find out and punish them even more harshly than ever. During a session where the Sefton has the telescope set up, Harry Shapiro and Animal try to sneak into the Russian prisoners' camp to look inside the windows of the delousing shack, using a pot of white paint to mark a line down the center of the road. They get much farther than anyone has a right to, but they are caught very quickly by a German guard. They do manage to escape back into the camp when they smack him in the eyes with the brush. A new prisoner arrives. It's Lieutenant James Dunbar. He's played by Don Taylor. He's being kept at Stalag 17 until the Germans can ship him to the officers' camp. Dunbar is greeted by the rest of the barracks, but there's immediate friction between him and Sefton. It turns out that Sefton is from the same suburb of Boston as Dunbar, and he tells everybody that Dunbar is from a rich family and he should be pampered during his stay. Dunbar lets the first few comments slide, but he finally tells Sefton, "Hey, you can resent my family's wealth, but you should watch your step." Sefton tells Dunbar that his family fortune will not protect him here in the camp, and Sefton leaves the barracks to an unknown destination. We learn that Dunbar has been brought to Stalag 7, or would have been brought, rather, to Stalag 17 earlier, but there was a major delay coming out of Frankfurt. It turns out that a German munitions train was destroyed just outside the city and snarled much of the Reichsbahn transport for miles around. The sergeant that accompanied Dunbar tells everyone it was Dunbar himself who blew up the train. Dunbar doesn't really want to talk about it, but eventually he says he rigged a simple time bomb and tossed it aboard the train as it was leaving the station. Schultz shows up, telling the men they'll be getting new blankets in time for a visit from a representative of the Geneva Conventions. The commandant wants to give the appearance that the camp is complying with regulations, but the men all know that the blankets will be confiscated as soon as the Geneva agent leaves. Schultz also confiscates the radio. He plays coy for a little bit before revealing its hiding place in the bucket. He also sees that a new message has been left for him by the spy. He orders the men outside to get their blankets, and he retrieves the hidden message. After the men file back into the barracks, they turn on Cookie, demanding to know where Sefton has been for the past few hours. Finally, Hoffman gives them permission for them to break into Sefton's footlocker, and they discover a whole world of contraband that Sefton has been hoarding. Duke appears and tells them that he knows where Sefton disappeared to. He's been over at the Russian women's barracks partying with them. Hoffman smashes the telescope out of anger. When Sefton comes back, he finds the men all staring at him and that his footlockers have been broken into. Hoffman and the rest of the men suggest that he's the German spy they've been unable to identify. Sefton claims he's innocent, and then the commandant suddenly makes an appearance and arrests Dunbar for suspicion of sabotaging the train that was destroyed near Frankfurt. Dunbar is taken into custody, and the men become angrier with Sefton, immediately suspecting him. They close in on him, and they give him a beatdown. The next morning, it's Christmas Eve. The men are rousted out by Schultz to get Red Cross parcels brought by the Geneva agent, but a mistaken shipment has left the men with a huge supply of ping pong balls instead. Sefton is nearly unable to get out of bed, and Schultz notices that he's been severely beaten. Sefton tries to bribe Schultz into revealing the identity of the traitor, but he is turned down. When the other prisoners walk in on them and see Sefton with Schultz, they're further convinced that he's the traitor. Hoffman tells Sefton that he tried to get Sefton transferred to another barracks, but couldn't. Sefton tells everyone he'll find out who the traitor is. Schultz walks in with the Geneva agent, who inspects the barracks, but he does see through the ruse of beautifying the camp because the blankets smell like mothballs and the meat that's supposed to be in the men's meal is not there. When he asks Price and Harry about the conditions they live in, they give noncommittal answers, but they're not going to talk about problems either. When he questions Sefton about his obvious injuries, Sefton doesn't say anything. But Hoffman takes the opportunity to tell the agent about Dunbar being taken to the commandant's quarters without formal charges, and the agent promises to investigate. We jump over to the commandant's apartment. Dunbar is being forced to stand upright in an attempt to make him confess. Dunbar is held out so far, but he's rapidly becoming weaker with the lack of sleep he had while being taken to the camp. The commandant calls his superior to let him know he has caught the saboteur responsible for the Frankfurt train explosion. When the Geneva agent arrives, he asks about Lieutenant Dunbar. The agent tells von Scherbach that he cannot torture Dunbar in this manner without proof. The commandant agrees and says he'll find out about the time bomb that Dunbar allegedly used. Later in the day, the men celebrate with a small tree they decorate with their dog tags, which were the tree was smuggled to them by Marco and Steve. The men have traded Sefton's distillery equipment for the camp's phonograph, and they begin to sing When Johnny Comes Marching Home. Price sneaks away from the group and sees that the cord for the light used to flag a message has been looped. Revealing himself as the traitor, he's able to switch the Black Queen for a new one. Sefton, still recovering in his bed, notices that the loop in the cord is gone. Later, while playing horseshoes with Bagration, Price asks him how the lieutenant could have carried any explosive device with him through the German prisoner searches in the train station. Bagration tells him Dunbar simply folded a lit cigarette into a book of matches. When the cigarette burned down, it lit the matches, causing a fire that detonated the ammunition. That night, the men gather around the tree and they sing Christmas carols. Sefton notices that the loop in the cord has reappeared. Suddenly, the camp lights go out, and Schultz tells them all to evacuate and duck into the trenches used in case of bombings. Schultz waits until everyone leaves and begins talking in German to Price, who had lingered behind to make sure the barrack was empty. He shows Schultz how Dunbar sabotaged the train by using the method Bagration had told him about. After they leave, Sefton steps out from a hiding spot, having heard the whole thing. On Christmas Day, the men throw a party in their barracks with music and much of the liquor and wine that Sefton had been hoarding. Animal gives Joey a new ocarina as a gift. Sefton talks to Cookie about the traitor in their midst, but even Cookie is suspicious now. Sefton talks about the potential consequences of revealing the traitor to the others and what punishment they would face if they killed the man outright. Sefton suggests that a plan to get rid of the traitor and look blameless is needed. Cookie suggests that Sefton tell Hoffman or Price. And Sefton considers this briefly. Hoffman shows up and announces that the SS has arrived to take Dunbar into custody. His method for destroying the ammo train has been uncovered. Hoffman tells the men that they've come up with a plan to rescue Dunbar from the SS. All the men from the other barracks will disperse outside and help with a diversion. Sefton seizes the opportunity to demand that he stay in the barracks and be guarded by someone they trust. Sefton suggests Price. Outside, the men have Steve drop a smudge pot near the SS agent's car. When the cover from it is thick enough, also making it impossible for the tower guards to open fire, a small group of the men rush the SS guards and grab Dunbar, stashing him away. The commandant runs checks of every man against their records. The barracks are thoroughly searched, and the prisoners are forced to stand in the yard for several hours, but Dunbar is never found. We learn that he's hiding out in one of the water towers above one of the latrines. That night, Hoffman calls a meeting where they'll collect everyone's dog tags with the exceptions of Joey and Sefton and draw the name of the man who will get Dunbar out of the water tower and out of the camp through the barbed wire. When the name is drawn, Price intercepts the tag and says he'll go. He figures the work that he's done as barracks security chief has been less than adequate, and he'd like to make it up to the men. Another trapdoor is cut in the floor, and as he prepares to leave, Sefton steps forward, announces another wager that Dunbar will never make it out of the camp. The men are instantly furious with him, but he slowly begins to reveal Price as the traitor. He approaches Price and asks him where he was when Pearl Harbor was bombed. Price says he was having dinner at 6 in the evening, but it was 6 p.m. in Germany, while America was getting the news earlier in the day. Sefton tells everyone that Price has sworn loyalty to his family's homeland and gone back to Germany when the war broke out. He had been trained as a spy and then planted in the camp. Price tries to escape through the trapdoor, but he is easily caught and subdued. Sefton then tells everyone he'll be the man to get Dunbar out. Now he likes the odds because they can use Price as a decoy. Considering that he'd sold out Johnson and Manfredi when they tried to escape, Hoffman and the other prisoners are ready for some payback. So they're going to throw Price out the door with cans tied to his leg, and then he'll draw the searchlights and the gunfire from the Germans in the guard towers. Sefton slips down through the trap door, bidding everyone farewell, and he sneaks over to the latrine. He has to get Dunbar, who is freezing at this point, out of the water tank and waits for the signal. When Price is thrown out into the yard, he draws fire from all the towers despite his shouting to them in German. As he tries to approach the commandant's offices, he's finally gunned down. Meanwhile, at the edge of the camp, Sefton cuts through the wire fence, and he and Dunbar escape into the woods. In the yard, the commandant and Schultz first smile at the corpse lying in the mud, but then they're surprised to find out that it's not Dunbar, but Price. In the barracks, the men reflect on how well Sefton's plan worked. The animal suggests that Sefton really just wanted to steal their wire cutters. And finally, Cookie begins whistling When Johnny Comes Marching Home.
Which is what the men had been singing on Christmas Eve earlier in the movie. So that's a fitting touch. So this is the first Billy Wilder movie we've talked about on this program. Yeah. As I've mentioned before, Wilder is in my pantheon of favorite directors of all time, along with Bergman, John Ford, Kurosawa and Scorsese. This also happens to be the very first movie of Wilder's that I ever saw on TV. I think when I was a preteen, that's when we saw it on TV. Hmm. And as I mentioned at the top of the program, this is not a movie that most people who were fans of Wilder would call one of his best, even though it did pretty well at the box office and with reviewers at the time, and garnered a couple of Oscar nominations, including Best Actor for William Holden, which he won, although he always thought later that this was a consolation prize Oscar that he won for not being nominated for the previous time that he and Wilder worked together, Sunset Boulevard, which is considered one of Wilder's best. And as you might have been able to tell from Claude's description, we've got quite a clash of tones with this movie, which I'm going to talk about in further detail in a bit. We've got comedy antics, some of which haven't even been mentioned yet, which we'll get into. And then we've got the spy story of the men trying to find out who in their midst is a traitor. And I'll talk more about that as well. And part of the criticism, I think, from some people about this movie is that the two stories don't really work well together, primarily because of the clash of tones.
I'd be in that camp, and, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just about to ask that, but okay. Because I personally did not think the tones clashed at all, or at least not egregiously. I thought it worked well together. So let's hear why you didn't think it worked.
Well, I'll frame it this way, is that I think some of the humor was, if this had been, let's say, like a drama with some humorous overlays, and you need that in some dramas, you got to break the tension once in a while. So I'm not opposed to funny moments in dramatic movies, but I think for me, some of the comedy was just a little too broad. And I'm thinking mostly of the animal character. You know, he was like a very clowny kind of guy. He was always with the big facial expressions and the over-emoting on things. And as much as I liked the gag with painting the stripe out of the camp, you know, for the most part, he was just like a little bit too goofy of a character. And that, I think, for me, was the part that kind of clashed with the rest of the film. You know, there are other parts which I think worked out really well, you know, like, the idea of, you know, a character with a Jewish name and celebrating Christmas and how that might, you know, work out and that kind of thing. And there are reasons why that could conceivably happen, is because a lot of Jewish soldiers actually disguise themselves by having their dog tags marked as something other than Jewish. So yes, it's possible to have a character like that in the film. But I think that would be the issue that I had, is sometimes when moments were played for comedy, they were played too much for comedy, and it wasn't just a moment to kind of, you know, break it for just a little bit, get the audience to relax as we move into the next phase of the film.
Okay, I understand that. By the way, the actor we're talking about, Robert Strauss, also received an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor, make of that what you will. But here's the thing. While he does play broadly, I will admit, not just by himself, but when he's teamed with Harvey Lembeck, who plays Harry Shapiro, you know, he also does rather serious things in the movie as well. He is always, even though he has to be woken up to do it, you know, he's always there to do the grunt work when it comes to pushing Cookie around to try and find out where Sefton is. He's one of the more threatening people doing that. When everyone finally confronts Price near the end, He doesn't say anything comic to him. He says, stop squirming, Price. There'll be no pardon from no general or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he was just a buffoon.
No, and I'll give him this. He was also kind of like, he kind of cast himself as Joey's protector too. Like he took the took the ocarina away to keep Joey out of trouble, but he also replaced it later on. And that's why I made a point of saying that.
And then he's also the one to read Joey a letter from home.
Right.
And he's trying desperately to get Joey to respond. So he is a more well-rounded character, I would believe, than just a buffoon. But I guess we'll have to agree to disagree.
But the thing is, when he slides into buffoonery, it's way into buffoonery. That's my issue.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll have to agree to disagree about that. Now, this was a transitional film for Wilder. And let me back up for a bit and explain that. Like a lot of writers in the studio era who became directors and even afterwards, including one that we talked about a couple times on the show, Preston Sturges, Wilder turned to directing because he didn't like what was being done to his scripts. As a matter of fact, he and Sturges both had their last straw with the same director, Mitchell Leeson, who directed a movie that Wilder co-wrote called Hold Back the Dawn. Unlike most writers who became a director as well, Wilder always worked with a co-writer. Part of that, as he said, is because as anyone who's written anything for a living, writing is a lonely job. As anyone who's written anything for a living knows, writing is a lonely job, and having someone to write with you makes it less lonely. But also because even though he lived in the U.S. for most of his life, about 60, 65 years, he never was entirely comfortable with English as a language. So he wanted someone to work with to make sure that he got it right. And he had two major writing partnerships in his career. The first one was with Charles Brackett, whom he first was teamed up with when he came to Paramount. And the other one was with, and that lasted from the film Midnight in the late 30s up through Sunset Boulevard, with the exception of Double Indemnity, which Brackett didn't like, and so Raymond Chandler co-wrote the screenplay for that. And then the other major partner he had was IAL Izzy Diamond, who started working with Wilder on Love in the Afternoon in 1957, and then with the exception of Witness for the Prosecution, where Wilder was paired with someone else when co-writing and directing that, Diamond remained his partner for the rest of their careers, up through their last movie, Buddy Buddy, about which, sadly, the less said, the better. And Stalag 17 was the second movie that Wilder had written after dissolving the partnership with Brackett. The previous one was Ace in the Hole, which I'm going to get back to in a little bit, actually right now, because it was also the second to last movie that Wilder did with Paramount. And the reasons for that are, A, Paramount was not happy that Ace in the Hole had bombed with critics and the box office, although now it's seen by many people, myself included, as not only one of Wilder's best films, but also one of the best films ever made. And Wilder, in turn, was not happy about the fact that Paramount wanted him for this movie to change the bad guys from Nazis to Polish communists. considering the fact that Wilder lost his mother and other family members in the Holocaust, that was not going to sit well with him. And so after this film and his follow-up film, Sabrina, Wilder left Paramount and eventually found a home at United Artists, which is a whole nother story. So again, this was a transitional film for Wilder. The screenwriter that he was working with for the one and only time was a guy by the name of Edwin Blum. And they were adapting a play, which I have never read, by Donald Bevan and Edmund Trzynski. Trzynski, by the way, shows up in the movie as the soldier who gets a letter from home from his wife claiming that she found the baby on their doorstep. And he's the one who keeps saying, "Why don't you think that I believe it? I believe it.
Yeah.
I believe it." And of course, he's not convinced, and we're not convinced at all, that the baby isn't from another man. The play had been directed by Jose Ferrer, and it was a modest hit, but not a big one. And originally, the character of Sefton was supposed to be more of a heroic figure. And Charlton Heston, if you can believe it, was supposed to play him in the movie version. But then Wilder decided to make Sefton more antisocial and more of an anti-hero, and out went Heston. And for my money, the better, because as I mentioned when we talked about Planet of the Apes in our first episode, I have never been a fan of Heston as an actor, let alone as a person. And Kirk Douglas, who had been in Ace in the Hole, was offered the role of Sefton, but he turned it down. And he later called that one of the biggest mistakes of his career. So Holden was the third choice. And just as with Sunset Boulevard, Holden was not initially happy about taking the role, even though he liked Wilder and got along with him through filming, but he wanted to make the character more sympathetic. He kept pleading to Wilder, "Look, can't I have at least one scene where Sefton says, 'Look, I hate the Nazis just as much as you all do,'" but Wilder refused. And I'll mention more about that in a minute, but that's one of the reasons why I think the movie works so well, is because Holden does not ingratiate himself with you at all. And he plays, although he had played nice guys well before and after that, I think with this and Sunset Boulevard, he does very well playing this tough, cynical, takes no bull from anybody type of person. The only part of the movie, the only part of his performance that didn't work for me at all was right after when he leaves, he gives this speech to the rest of the prisoners and said, "If I ever run into any of you bums on the street, let's just pretend we never met." And he ducks down, and then he ducks back up, gives a smile and a wave. That smile and a wave felt phony to me. But everything else about the performance, I think, is terrific.
Yeah, it really is. And I think it was a smart move on Wilder's part not to make Holden a little bit more sympathetic throughout the film, because we're left wondering. You know, we're thinking, hey, you know, he's probably not. He's a greasy guy, that kind of thing. But no, maybe not. But maybe, you know, he could be the traitor. And so we don't really know through most of the film until the point finally where we see Price manipulating the chess piece and the light bulb and, you know, that sort of thing. And so even then, you've got Sefton is not even a hero as such, but he's just the innocent guy who is not being, you know, who's not being taken seriously by the rest of the barracks, who really can't necessarily find a way to prove his own innocence. But in some cases, he's not really inclined to prove his own innocence until finally when he gets beaten up and he takes that opportunity to say, okay, we've got to figure this out. So when he sees what happens with Price and the light and Schultz and that kind of thing, and it cooks up the scheme to out him as the traitor, you know, we're still in a little bit of anti-hero mode rather than turning him from this ambiguous guy into full-scale hero. So I actually think that extra little pop-up with the wave and the salute, it was like, that wasn't bad. It was a neat little bit. It was like, I said this terrible thing, but you know what? I'm going to back off on that just a little bit. So long, fellas, because you did help me get out.
Yeah, I can sort of see that. But again, it just felt like a little bit of pandering to me.
Yeah, it could be.
But let's talk about the little things that Wilder does to make this mystery, because this is a mystery that we're trying to solve here,
yeah,
who
sure.
the traitor is, work. I have not read the play, nor have I seen it, but I understand that the way the traitor was discovered in the original play was entirely an overheard conversation. Wilder was the one who added things like the light bulb and the chess piece. So that was a way of us being able to say, okay, here's the signal. Now, who is Schultz signaling to? And also, another thing that I didn't pick up until I had seen this movie a few times, if you'll notice, Price, Peter Graves, Sefton, William Holden, and Dunbar, Don Taylor, who up to that point, I think, was best known for playing the groom in the original version of Father and the Bride, they're all around the same height, same build. They've all got dirty blonde hair, although Sefton's, of course, is shaved. But Price and Dunbar, you know, their hair is done in a similar way. And they're all wearing the same type of airman jacket throughout the movie with the fur-lined collar.
Mm.
So when Price gets thrown out into the compound at the end of the film and gunned down by the Nazis, you can easily believe that they would think at first, oh, we got Dunbar, and then only to have a massive feeling of, oh, crap, when they turn it over and realize that they killed the spy that was planted in their own camp by their higher-ups. So that's a nice little touch there, I thought, that Wilder added.
Yeah, that is. I hadn't picked that up.
Yes, and we should mention, by the way, that the costumer on this movie was not mentioned here. There's no costume director. There's no costume designer credited on this movie that I can see. But whoever did the costumes on the movie deserves credit for that touch. Another thing that Wilder did, even though he was not what you'd call a method director, is just as with Almost Famous, which we discussed a couple episodes previous, he shot the entire movie in sequence so that the actors themselves didn't really know who the traitor was, because the script, although Wilder had written the movie out before he started shooting, he'd give that to the actors, you know, just a little bit earlier so that they would know what they were shooting. and would have time to remember their lines, but they didn't know who the traitor was either. So the hostility that you sense between the actors throughout the entire movie feels more real because of that.
That's interesting. I mean, you'd think that maybe one of them had seen the play and would have some kind of idea who the traitor was. That's kind of interesting. The IMDb lists J. Allen Sloan as the wardrobe director for this film.
Okay, so all credit to Mr. Sloan then for that bit of costume design there. Now, Holden wasn't the only person in the movie who was sort of playing against type here. I've never watched the show Community. I don't know if you ever did, Claude.
Oh, yeah.
But, okay, so Richard Erdman is not an unknown actor to you then.
Correct.
Because he was on Community. And he had done mostly comedies before that. And then a couple years after Stalia 17 came out, after that as well. But Wilder cast him as the one person, Hoffy, who doesn't make any cracks and who barely cracks a smile throughout the entire movie. And Erdman was, like Holden with his role, a little bit uncomfortable with that at first, but he grew to understand what Wilder was doing. And he does a very good job, it should be said, as Hoffy. You know, he convinces you that he can be a leader of all these guys, that he's able to keep Duke and everyone who wants to string up Sefton at bay, while also doing his best to make sure that things are running smoothly and trying to find out who the traitor is as well. And I think he does a good job with that.
He does. It should be noted that everybody in the barracks is a sergeant. All right. This is a sergeant's barracks. So chances are this isn't a matter of, like, you know, Hoffy, you know, outranking anybody as such, but he is just the guy upon whom, like, he carries himself with a certain level of authority. Or it's also possible that the Germans just said, like, elect a leader among you. This is going to be the guy who represents you, you know, when we have to talk to one person. Don't really know, but he does a really good job. For those of you who are fans of Community, he played the character Leonard, who was a recurring character on the show. And he would come in and he would say something obnoxious and everybody would have this "shut up, Leonard" type line. And there would be something weird about it. So it'd be like, "Shut up, Leonard. I've seen your internet search history." Something weird like that. He was one of the older students attending the school.
Yes. And by the way, everyone in the barrack, yes, is a sergeant until Dunbar shows up.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Dunbar, of course, is
an officer,
a lieutenant. And when the commandant comes by to take Dunbar because of throwing the time bomb on the train, he ostensibly claims he's there to move Dunbar to better quarters because an officer shouldn't be mixed up with sergeants. Of course, he's lying, but... And speaking of the commandant, he is played by Otto Preminger, who, although was most famous for being a director, also acted on more than one occasion. Fans of the Batman TV show will know that he was one of three actors to play Mr. Freeze on the show. And he and Sig Ruman, who plays Schultz, have in some ways the most difficult task because they also have some comedy business to do. And yet at the same time, you have to believe that they are threats, and they are able to do so very well. Ruman, you could argue, is also going over the top, but again, I think he makes it work, just like he did when he played another Nazi in a wartime comedy, Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be, a decade earlier. And one way that Wilder sort of humanizes the Commandant, even though, of course, he's a villain and a bad guy, is in that scene where he calls his superiors to tell them that he's caught the von Schirbach. Von Schirbach has caught the guy who blew up the German munitions tank. That whole scene has, I don't know if this was in the play or something that Wilder added in the movie, but that whole scene where he's putting on his boots just so that when he's on the phone, he can click his heels. And takes them off again after the phone conversation is over. And then when the Geneva man comes by and he's not wearing the boots, he's wearing his socks. As the Geneva man is leaving, von Schirbach says to him, "You'll pardon me for my appearance." And the Geneva man says, "Perfectly all right, I do not like boots." So you know that even he has to answer to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he actually does a pretty good job of being that, like, on the surface jovial character, but at the same time, there's that undercurrent of menace to almost everything that he says, and it works out really well. The other thing that they do to humanize him a little bit is that he becomes this guy who does have to have the boards put out over the mud so that he can walk on it. And again, the boards get removed as he walks away. So there are certain, you know, things that where he is kind of placing himself in a position over people and doing some things specifically for their appearance, for the way it makes him look.
Right. Now, let's get back to the main plot of Sefton and the trying to find out who the traitor is. Wilder was not someone that was thought of as a political filmmaker per se. And if you ever asked him about that, while Wilder in real life was a lifelong Democrat, and he formed the Committee for the First Amendment to protest when the House of Un-American Activities Committee called them the Hollywood 10 to grill them. And he was one of only two directors not to sign the loyalty oath that the Directors Guild put out in the early 50s. The other, by the way, was John Huston. Wilder himself would have scoffed at any notion that he was a political filmmaker. As far as he was concerned, he was there to entertain, and that's it. And yet, at the same time, it is not going too far to suggest that this movie was a kind of allegory about McCarthyism. The fact that Sefton, because he is A, not a likable guy at all, and B, is trading with the Nazis, that he must be in league with the Nazis himself. And even though that's really not good evidence, everyone in the barracks is convinced of it anyway. It's not too much of a stretch to go from A to B and say this was a veiled attack on the blacklist and McCarthyism that was going on at the time. And because Wilder doesn't really call attention to that as well, it works all the better as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it does. I'm just trying to think about the era itself, like when during World War II, and there was a very, you know, with us or against us kind of thing, but not in the same way that we've had in recent years. And I think about this because one of my side interests is like World War II era ephemera and some of the things. And I'm looking like specifically at like advertising and movie posters and that kind of thing. And and radio programs. And one of the things that I really, really take to is anything that makes an oblique reference to the war and the propaganda that was going on. And, you know, it was like, if you drive your car alone, you might as well have Hitler sitting next to you in the car because you're wasting gasoline and not taking another person with you and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's a very patriotic kind of thing there. And I think as we moved into the 50s and the McCarthy era, you know, scene, yeah, I could see that as a little bit of a rebellious sort of move, sure.
Especially since you had all kinds of anti-communist movies coming out during that time. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk a little more about that in a future episode. But this, you know, this was a way to smuggle anti-McCarthyism into the discussion here, I think. Now, two other aspects of the movie I want to talk about very quickly before we wrap this up. One is the music. As with a movie that we talked about on the previous episode, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the score is often made up of percussion, specifically snare drum. The score, by the way, is credited to Franz Waxman, who was mostly known for his horror scores. But the snare drum that happens after the opening credits when Manfredi and Johnson are waiting to go out as the spotlights go, and then the snare drum as the rest of the barracks is getting ready to throw Price out of the compound. That's very effective to help build up suspense. I mean, there are other more traditional music that plays in the movie, and then there are songs playing in the movie as well. Not just when Johnny comes marching home again, but also when they're having the Christmas Day party right before Hoffy comes in to tell them that Dunbar is being taken away. We have a guy singing along to a song called I Love You. And that guy, by the way, is played by Ross Bagdasarian, mm-hmm. who would be better known later in his life as David Seville, the voice of Alvin and the Chipmunks. But most of the score is that percussion. And as I said, I think it's used very effectively in this movie.
It is. I mean, it doesn't seem out of place at all because this is a military story film. And so, you know, you kind of expect to hear drum beats here and there. And this is going to be, yes, we're going to get into that military kind of mood. But that said, you know, it also is used effectively as a means, as you say, of ratcheting up the tension from time to time. It's not just a signal that, you know, here's a military situation, here are army fellas, here are this, that, the other thing. You know, it's also when you see scenes like the men all out in the yard and the commandant is coming out and basically the music is running in time with the commandant's steps, that kind of thing. That, again, it's one more of those things that heightens the tension and the menace that the commandant is carrying with him, even as he maintains this, you know, hey, I'm your friend kind of exterior.
Right. And then let's also talk about, because it's going to lead into the TV series that was spun off this, let's talk about the other comedy bits that are in this movie, aside from the antics of Harry and Animal. One of my favorite bits is the guy who plays Bagration, who's actor you didn't mention. His name is Jay Lawrence. And he does impressions throughout the movie. He from Adolf Hitler, which is basically done as an FU to Schultz. He also does Clark Gable, Ronald Colman, although I first mistook him for Maurice Chevalier.
that's James, that's quite the confusion there.
Yeah, but the way he does the Coleman accent, you could swear it's got a French tinge to it, which is why I thought it was Chevalier. James Cagney, which is a particularly brilliant bit because that's when he's describing how Dunbar destroyed the Germans' munition train. And then Cary Grant, which is sort of hilarious in a way as well, because Wilder had always wanted to work with Grant, but never got the opportunity because Grant always turned him down. He wanted him for Love in the Afternoon and Sabrina, and Grant turned him down both times.
And then, of course, and a couple of years later, we get Tony Curtis doing the Cary Grant voice for Some Like It Hot. Was that 59?
Yes.
And but the best part of that is Jack Lemmon's line where he says, "Nobody talks like this."
Yes. So, but all of that, all of his impressions, I think work very well in the movie. Did you like them as well or no?
They were okay. I think I got a little bit worried, and I hadn't seen this film in a long time. So when, you know, rewatching it, I had kind of forgotten about that part of the film. And I was like, oh, he doesn't do this throughout the film, does it? Because that's going to get a little bit old. And he did like a couple there. He did the Cary Grant thing, and he stopped it as you, I'm sorry, now with the Jimmy Cagney thing, and he finished it with the Cary Grant, and that was pretty much the end of it. It was like he kind of faded into the background as a character and then came back and did the Cary Grant. And so I was like, okay, this isn't so bad after all. It does, I mean, when he does it, you're right, he does it very, very well, and it works in the moment. But if it was like that's going to be this guy's entire shtick, then no, I'm not really having it.
Yeah, and the one comedy bit that maybe doesn't quite work as well today as it might have been then is Betty Grable.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's of its time. I guess we can frame it that way. You got to know who Betty Grable was, and you know, it's but Betty Grable was like ridiculously famous at the time, especially again among the GIs and for the pinup pictures and that sort of thing. There were a lot of pinup girls, of course, but I think she was arguably the most famous one.
Right.
And so the fact that it doesn't hold up is only because of time, not because it's like an especially, you know, bad or egregiously, you know, non PC kind of situation. It's just dated. It dated itself out.
Okay. And that leads us to, so what is the TV show that was quote-unquote inspired by Stalag 17? And that would be Hogan's Heroes, a sitcom that ran in the 60s and starred, among other people, Werner Klemperer as a character who's very similar to Schultz. And also Richard Dawson, about a decade before Family Feud made him a household name. And although the makers of Hogan's Heroes always insisted that the show was not inspired by Stalag 17, the creators of Stalag 17 were upset enough in feeling that it was plagiarized that they actually sued the makers of Hogan's Heroes and eventually settled out of court. Now, I have not really been able to make myself watch an entire episode of Hogan's Heroes, so I can see somewhat of a shallow connection, but nothing more substantial, I should say. How about you, Claude? Did you ever watch the show?
I did as a kid. It was like one of those shows that would run in reruns every single morning or afternoon or whenever I watched it. I remember watching it as a young kid. And I could see some definite lines A to B on this one. You've got a Sergeant Schultz, you've got this commandant, you've got the stove that is that is disguising the trapdoor that appeared in Hogan's Heroes. There was a regular tunnel that the Nazis never discovered in the series. And so you could easily, I mean, draw those lines. I'm trying to think back as far as some of the characters, and I'm just like looking at the entry here really quick. You know, I want to mention
mm-hmm. to correct myself, Klemperer did not play the Schultz character.
He played the Colonel, yeah.
Colonel Klink. It was John Banner who played the Sergeant Schultz character.
Yeah, I overlooked that. But I think that the various characters within the barracks, you really can't draw an A to B line in that respect. I mean, like, you know, you couldn't say that Bob Crane is the Hoffman character, or that, you know, Richard Dawson was this character, or anything like that. And of course, Ivan Dixon has no counterpart in Stalag 17 because there were no black guys in the barracks. So, but the very fact of that they're in a German prison camp, that you've got a Sergeant Schultz who is a little boisterous and overdoing it, and maybe like he's portrayed as kind of dumb and easily fooled in Hogan's Heroes, but his name is Sergeant Schultz. Oh, and by the way, they're in Stalag 17.
Okay, I did not know that, but as I said, I have not seen Hogan's Heroes. So is there anything you want to add to this before we wrap this up?
No, I think we have exhausted this one plenty.
Okay, so stay tuned, because in part two, we're going to be talking about Singles.
That's coming up immediately in your podcast feed, so stick around.